Don't pound the table too much.
Okay. Let me have your attention. So will the intro to engineering students raise their hands? I can count them. That's easy. 2, 4, 6, 7. All right. Senior Design 1. You put them. Thanks. Senior Design 1. All right. Quite a lot of them, I think. Senior Design 2. All right. So first, I would like the Senior Design 1 and intro. Well, Senior Design 1, I'd like everyone to give a hand to the Senior Design 2 and the intro students because you did manage to survive final presentation. Now, we'll see how many survive the final hardware prototypes today, this week. So, today we're going to have a talk by a couple of my colleagues, and what I'm going to do is let them introduce themselves, because they're going to talk a little bit about who they are, but there's a couple to take away from the talk. Engineering issues. The business they work in is one that's very intense about the design process you're following in this course, and they're going to talk a lot about that. You don't just put a satellite up in space and hope that it works, and if it doesn't work, you don't pull it down, fix it, and send it back up again. And they're going to talk a lot about what it takes to actually do that successfully. The second thing, though, is that they represent a segment of the job market that you're probably very unfamiliar with, which represents a very large section of the engineering job market. So I would encourage you, as they talk today, to ask questions about not just the technology they're talking about, but also the job functions that they and their colleagues perform. Because these are job functions that most of you as engineers are going to be performing. 90-95% of engineers do not actually do the kind of core technical engineering you think you're going to be doing when you graduate. And you'll learn a little bit about that today. So without further ado, I'll introduce our guests, and they can tell you their names and where they're from and how they got to this point of being very good at what they do. Welcome. Thank you.
Actually, can everyone hear me? Okay, very good. Not by a flip of a coin, my colleague decided that I would go first. Unfortunately, usually ladies are first, but in this case, I've taken the cake here. Anyway, Joe asked me to give you guys a little brief introduction to myself. Tim Settles, my name. Born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. Went to school at Milwaukee School of Engineering, where I worked, and then did my graduate work at Purdue University, West Lafayette, Indiana. The ones clapping.
That's okay.
Let's talk about how I actually got into engineering. It actually began, just as probably a lot of you did, as a little kid, I was very curious. Now, don't laugh at me when I tell you this, but I was always very intrigued by the sounds coming out of a radio. And at first thought, you know, I'm thinking, are there people in there? I wanted to know. So what did I do? My dad's radio bar.
Oh.
That wasn't good. Because, he beat my butt for that. But nonetheless, I discovered two things. One, there was something else other than people in there making the sounds come out, but I still didn't understand what it was. I wanted to know. So that's probably what kind of parlayed me into going into engineering, or at least some aspect of science. And so I went through high school, some math classes, some physics classes, decided to enroll in school and get into an engineering program. And yeah, it was tough, very tough. It did not come easy to me at all. But I had no intention, by the way, of going all the way through and earning a PhD. I simply thought I'll get this bachelor's degree, get out there, make some good money, and I'm good for the rest of my life. Well, that wasn't the case. As it turned out, my curiosity continued to grow. As I learned a little bit more in my undergrad studies, I wanted to understand what's behind this engineering, the math behind it, the physics behind it, so I just continued on my education. If you choose to do the same thing, one of the key aspects of becoming a successful PhD student is not necessarily how smart you are, it's how stubborn you are. It is how stubborn you are. You're going to run up against professors that are far harder than Joe Kony. They're going to be far demanding than he is. And what's going to be the difference between those who will stay in that program and succeed and graduate versus those who will drop out? I have met many of guys and women who were far smarter, more talented than me intellectually, but they were not stubborn enough to stay in the program. And they dropped out. Now, I'm not saying they're not, you know, talented people nonetheless. Still, to get a PhD, one of the key components, well, you have to know something, don't get me wrong. You do have to know something, but stubbornness is going to be one of the key things that will get you through that program. Well, after I graduated, I kind of did things not normal. That is to say, I didn't go straight through bachelor's, master's, PhD. I got my bachelor's degree, started working. While I was working, I earned my master's, and while I was still working, I earned my PhD. That afforded me an advantage, I thought, over other graduate students, and that is, what? You can't hear me back there? Okay, I'll talk a little louder. I was able to at least understand a lot of real-world problems, because what's the one thing you have to do to get a PhD? Someone help me out here.
A dissertation.
Dissertation? Well, give me more about, what about dissertation?
Research.
Well, give me more. What about research? Experiment. Fundamentally, you have to contribute to the profession. You have to do something that hasn't been done before. Yes, you have to do a dissertation. Yes, you have to do research. But you can't research and produce a dissertation based on something that someone has already done. Your professor will not let you go with that at all. So, I was exposed to a lot of real-world problems while I was working on my professional job that allowed me to use that as part of my research and my PhD. So that's an advantage I had. A lot of students, my colleagues in school, however, had to struggle trying to find that problem, that unique problem no one had ever solved before. And that's not so easy, believe it or not. But that helped me out. It also played a good role for helping me to go in when I finally graduated, as well as giving me the insight on what new things could be done. And, you know, a lot of patents came out, a lot of work that I did as a result of that. So my career has been one of doing hardware design for manufacturing. I did a lot of that for automotive electronics, fairly harsh environment, fairly important as well. But that moved on to doing a lot of research work. And then now what I do is I typically do a lot of advice to the government. I'm a technical advisor to the government. They build and procure a lot of systems. They contract this work out to a lot of people. And they need some people to help them understand, well, is this contract BSME or not? I want to know. And that's kind of what my job is, to advise the government technically. And it exposes me to a lot of problems. I don't get to work on them necessarily, which is probably a downside to it. But at the same time, the role I play in government is still very important. And my colleague Penny does the same thing. With that said, I forgot to tell you, she's going to hand out some paraphernalia that we bought with us. There's a lot more we're going to have to give out here. We're going to try and make this a non-lecture, if you will. We know you guys get a lot of lectures throughout the year, and you got many more to go. What we hope to do here today is to have kind of a group involvement, and to those who are involved more, we're going to try and incentivize you a little bit to do so. Having said that, I'm going to finish handing it out. Okay. I will give the floor to Dr. Penny Hicks, who will introduce herself as well.
I guess Tim gave you kind of a history of himself, kind of how he got to where he's at today. I had a completely different path. Tim was like your golden child. Grew up and smart and gifted and studied. I was like the wild child. My dad was in the Army, and we moved all over the place while I was a kid. He finally retired, and we ended up in Florida when he went to work for NASA at Kennedy Space Center. So I spent my years from that point on pretty much out in the middle of nothing. Right? Because at that point in time, when they moved there, my parents brought us there, the area around Kennedy Space Center was a big wilderness, right? A Florida-style wilderness. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of people there, And my dad, being your typical engineer, would go up into the facility where they do the launches, and I would be running around outside, except for during launches where I had to be inside the what they call the VAB, so that I wouldn't get burned up. But so I spent a lot of time as a kid in an environment where I could see a lot of cool stuff, but I was not really directly involved in that much of it. So I was running around outside doing whatever I felt like doing, which was good in a lot of ways, because I got a lot of sort of physical understanding of the world from doing stuff that a lot of kids today don't get to do, right? Because they don't get to run around unsupervised, running around the woods and climbing trees and building zip tracks and forts, you know, forts underneath the ground and all the other stuff that you do as a kid without parents running around after you. But didn't make me into the greatest student. So as I went through high school, there were certain classes that would get my attention, and I would get A's because I was paying attention and I was interested. And then there were others that I would get C's and D's because I didn't care. You know, it was boring to me. And even doing the work, like Spanish, right? Everybody has to, or had to take language when I was in high school, and I hated it. I mean, I spoke Spanish because my mother is from the Philippines. She speaks Spanish and Tagalog and a couple other languages, but homework, the concept of homework and studying was not in my vocabulary. In fact, I would skip school frequently to go surfing. So it wasn't until I got to be a senior and I got into a course that I was really interested in that suddenly I realized, if I'm going to do something like what my dad does in engineering, I better start paying attention and I better do it in a hurry, because I'm not going to succeed, I'm not going to get into college, and I'm not going to get help financially. I came from a very large family, so even though my dad was an engineer, they didn't have a lot of money, right? Because I had 6 siblings and a couple adopted siblings. If you have that many kids in the family, mom and dad are not going to pay for you to go to school. You're going to pay for yourself, or you are going to get financial help. So I had to really start busting my ass so that I could go from pretty much a C average, because I didn't care, to an A average. And also, from a student who really, and today I don't think you could do this. You know, you guys probably know this because you've just gone through that process in the last few years, but you know, you have to be involved. And I was involved in stuff, but it wasn't like what you guys have to do today. So I had to do this 180-degree turnaround, get into college and get funding so that I could get through. Well, I was lucky, being female and being a minority, that helped a lot. There were a lot of scholarships out there and merit funds that I could get because of those things and being in some kind of technical or scientific field. Being American also helped. Right? There's a lot of money out there for technical people who it's only set aside, like, we have some documents out here that we'll pass out later for funding from the NRO. And all of the agencies, which we actually work with a lot of, but the NRO is like a parent to a lot of these things. The CIA, the Air Force, NRO. Does anybody in here know what the NGA is? Or heard that acronym? The National Geospatial Agency. They are in charge of a lot of collection from satellites. So a lot of the imagery that you see out there, they are in charge of collecting a lot of that, and a lot more that you guys never get to see. So they all provide funding to people who are American students in technical fields, which is, for me, was a beautiful thing, because I got funded all the way through the PhD by NASA. And I actually, because I wasn't quite sober enough, I didn't finish one, but I went all the way through the ABD in the math program. So I have, just short of all I did was not publish the dissertation for the math PhD, and switched over to double E because I got to that point and realized I'm going to have the same degree in applied math, and I'm going to make $35,000 a year. Or I can get the exact same degree and do the same research that I'm doing in double E and get paid $80,000 a year. That's not a hard choice, is it? I wasn't bright enough to figure that out before I started the ABD path in math, but at least I finally got on the program and did the other end of that so that I could at least support myself. But I became a good student, learned how to study from that whole background of spending most of my days out there surfing and chasing around after alligators and having a good time versus studying, which I actually, in the end, felt lucky, and it's unfortunate that today you can't get away with that, right? Because the students have to really be so much more in high school to get into a good school. But I got the beauty of both worlds because I had a good time in high school. I really had a good time in high school until I finally decided to study, and then I still had a good time because I realized how valuable and interesting and entertaining learning can actually be. But all the engineers, almost all of them, that I have ever worked with and went to school with were a complete opposite, right? They were always focused, really smart, and studied, did well in school all the way through, versus, you know, my kind of backwards approach. So when I finished undergraduate school and I started looking around for grad school money, NASA was a natural choice because my dad worked for NASA. And then when I went into the PhD program, they funded that all the way through. So I was really lucky, and it kind of gave me a good start in a technical area without coming out with ridiculous debt. But I was also really lucky that they even took me, because most people who work for NASA didn't start that way, right? They started from that other track. And I ended up going through some of the other agencies as I progressed through the job path. I actually ran across Joe, your professor, when I was still with NASA, but I was also at Old Dominion University in Virginia, and I went to some of Joe's workshops on speech recognition, and we've kind of kept in touch ever since then. And moved on from NASA when they started to get to the point where the engineers weren't actually doing engineering work, in my opinion. So I went from being very hands-on implementation as well as research to kind of managing a lot of other engineers, and I didn't view that as fun. At that point, I wasn't ready for that, right? I wanted to be hands-on and be able to touch things and work and actually produce something as opposed to being an engineering manager. Well, I'm kind of more in that role now, like Tim told you, that I do get to oversee a lot of that stuff even though I'm not technically a manager. And it is rewarding and it's frustrating. Fortunately, we have a lot of flexibility. We can also do independent research on the side for what we do as advisors to the government. And then there are some projects that we end up actually doing troubleshooting, because believe it or not, a lot of the engineers out there really don't know what they're doing. And even some that are really good at what they do technically, they're not good at planning or documenting. So if you talk to them because they're having a problem on the hardware development or the software development and something's not working, and you're trying to troubleshoot with them, and you want to go back to their design documentation so that you can look at their schematics, look at their planning, look at how they did their interfaces, they will honestly sit there and tell you, well, we haven't done that yet. So you design this board without laying it out and doing analysis, running models, understanding what your inputs and outputs are, how they interact. Yes is the answer. And they will give it to you with confidence. That, so why do I need to do that? Doesn't it? Up until yesterday, it worked great. And now you've spent, 3 months later, they're still trying to diagnose a problem that occurs because they don't really understand their own system. They haven't documented it. They didn't do all that design work up front. They don't have all that stuff that they should have spent a large portion of their time in front doing all of that paperwork. Right, paper design, the documentation, the interfacing studies, and the documentation of the interface, so that later on when you run into these problems, you can study how the interactions are taking place in your system, if you will, through your documentation. You can do analysis that way. You can also do models via MATLAB, National Instruments product, whatever the product might be. Without all that documentation, it really puts you at a disadvantage. So I'm going to let Tim talk a little bit about some of the disadvantages that we've looked at in the more recent past with a developer who has a very complicated system. They've got a large processing computer portion of this. They've got an RF COM. They've got, lots of different pieces and moving parts all over the place. And these pieces and parts are not in one location. Okay, there are parts of it in one place, parts of it hundreds of miles away, and other parts of it thousands of miles away. And parts of it are unattended. So if they have a problem out there at the unattended portion, it's a problem. Right. If you can get in the car and drive to it, it's not such a big deal. But if you have to get on an airplane and drive to fly to it and think you've had problems because your design process was bad and you can't diagnose it from afar, that starts to get really expensive and time-consuming. And people start to get real irritated with you because you're having to go to those people who are paying you lots of money and say, well, can we go there again and send three or four people, technicians and equipment, and spend this huge amount of money and all this planning and logistics to send these people out to not just fix, but diagnose a problem that is on the other side of the planet. That's tens of thousands of dollars every time you do that. Hundreds in some cases, depending on the number of people that have to do this. And if you can keep it down to one person, maybe it's tens. But as soon as you start getting it to two or three people and equipment, you're now talking tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars for a diagnostic trip, right? Something you guys do in the lab every day, right? You're designing your systems for Dr. Piccone, and something doesn't work. So you spend days. How many people spend days trying to figure out problems? Weeks? Some people spend months. I personally spent a whole semester failed at a senior design project because my partner didn't do her amplification part. I wanted to kill her because we both got a C. But we spent the entire semester, the second half of class, trying to diagnose why we couldn't get a signal when we actually had a signal, but she hadn't done her amplifier properly, so the signal wasn't getting amplified. Now, if you have to do that from off-site, far away, it's still just as difficult, right? But the cost involved that your tax dollars and everybody else's has to pay for to send these developers out to do that is outrageous. So you want to talk about some of the kinds of technical issues that these guys have had to look at?
What we will do is I want to show you guys a video to introduce you to the organization that we support. And then we have a presentation. As we get into the presentation, I'll give you some what I'll call case studies of projects that Penny and I have worked on and some of the failures that they've had and the pitfalls that they've run into that could have been avoided had they done some proper planning up front. And as I said before, we'd like for this to not be a lecture and more of one where I want you guys to participate in this thing with me. So I'm going to ask questions. Look for answers. Joe's not going to grade you on it. Don't worry about that at all. Sorry. He's not going to grade you on it, but we will incentivize you by handing out these magic bags. They are indeed magic. I can't tell you the magic that it holds in there. You won't know until you get one in your hands. Okay. All right?
So having said that, let's start the video. It's a short video. It won't take 2 minutes long. So bear with us for a few minutes here while the video runs, and then we have a presentation. Thank you.
just letting you know what reconnaissance means. Nobody? Yes?
When I think of reconnaissance, I think of intelligence.
Okay.
Acquire knowledge that maybe others don't want you to know.
That's a good start. We in the intelligence community refer to that as denied area. So reconnaissance is collection. And exactly that, acquiring information with card for your efforts. We got all these really cool cards from the employment office. And they heard we were coming here, and they were like, oh, you have to come get this stuff. Give these guys some stuff and get their attention. Let them know we exist and what cool stuff we do. Which is completely opposite. When the NRO was born, it was what you refer to as a black agency. Nobody was allowed to know that they existed for many, many years. And we've got some pictures up here before Tim gets started. At the end, if you're interested, you can take an example from the first NRO mission that was in 1915. That was satellites that put up in the U.S., and there are three images up there of local areas, sort of, you guys, Baltimore, New York, and Washington, D.C., taken in that time frame. That I showed a picture to one of your grad students a little while ago, and he just looked at it and was like, no offense, but Google Earth is a lot better than that. And I said, really? This was taken in 1960. He changed his attitude after that. I was like, oh, okay. Obviously, Google didn't even exist in 1960. And most people didn't know that this technology existed in 1960. For a long time, people didn't know. And that community is that far ahead to date in technology development than commercial. So if you think back, probably way before any of you were born, to that time frame and what they can do then that the general public didn't know about, and if you can extrapolate that today, they're equally far away in certain areas of technology than the commercial industry, that unless you work in that field, you won't see this. You'll see it eventually, right? But it usually takes about 25 years for that stuff to be allowed to seep out to the public.
So as the video mentioned to you, the NRO has as a vision, vigilance from above. And as Penny just mentioned a while ago, the central role of their mission is intelligence. Go on to the next slide. The NRO plays a major role in the entire intelligence community. They are only a small portion of it. Their process includes this notion of tasking assets, doing collection, and processing the collection that has been taken. There are other agencies that then take that information and use it for exploitation, dissemination. Dissemination to who? A lot of bodies. Those bodies could be other agencies in the community, as well as various aspects of the Department of Defense as well. Next slide, please.
Can you read these things on the screen?
No. Okay. So, the NRO is a... And I just mentioned in the last slide, they support a large community within the government, but there are specific partners that they work with very closely, one of them being the National Geospatial Agency, NGA, that Penny mentioned a while ago, as well as the National Security Agency, that I'm sure you've heard of before. All of these are within what we call the collective intelligence community. And those guys, the NGA and NSA, make use of the collected information that the NRO does from their overhead assets. And they use that, as I mentioned in the last slide, to exploit that information and disseminate it. Next slide. So, the problems they try to solve, and this is kind of a segue, believe it or not, into your senior design project, because let me just stop for a moment here. I need someone to help me. Who can give me all the components involved in the design process? What do you begin with in your design? What's the first thing you do? Huh? Ooh. Problem statement. Very good. Give this woman a bag. Okay. Now, let me get you to understand something. That problem statement is not always technical. It could be something as simple as, I just want to fly across the Atlantic in 12 minutes. That's it. That's all you took. You as an engineer
Your job is to extract out of that problem statement some capabilities, technical capabilities, and then more importantly, technical requirements. It is those things you're going to do to formulate the design. What's the next thing you're going to do after you do that?
Approach. Ooh, what?
Approach.
Ooh, approach? Give me some more. What do you mean by approach?
How are you going to start solving the problem, basically?
Okay, very good. That deserves a bag, you think?
So, then our role goes after some very hard problems. As you can see up there, their problems are not technically stated, necessarily. The attributes of the overhead systems that they end up using to help solve these problems, they are indicative of things like rapidly being able to respond to a need, penetration to denied areas, for example. You can't send people everywhere, especially since you don't own that land. People get kind of upset about that. So you want to have it done in such a way that there's no risk to loss of life, a very important aspect. You may not be designing a senior project that's going to cause someone to lose their life or not, but let me tell you a story about automotive design. It has some safety aspects in it as well, does it not? And how many of you, when you drive your car, would like for the brakes to work when you press the brake? That's a good thing. That's a good thing. Now, how bad would it be if those brakes did not work?
Yeah, it's kind of bad, right? So there was a guy, an engineer, some time ago, who designed the braking system. And believe it or not, he had to design in such a way that it would be reliable over the period of the life of that car. And if he had not done that, guess what? Someone might lose their life. So it's very important. Very important. You need to pay attention to that. And then, in particular, this last point here, available 24/7, 365, that is an attribute of the system that the NRO deploys, but it might be an attribute of some project you're working on as well. Let me give you a second example. Not as serious as the NRO satellite you might put up, but let's say you're designing a network for people to use to access the internet. And so that kind of thing, particularly in this day and age, is often accessed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. When you go into your dorm room or wherever you happen to live and you turn your computer, you expect the internet to come up. When it doesn't, what do you do? Freak out. So, well, that's probably as honest a response as I'll ever get.
You freak out because you're expecting that thing to be available to you on demand 24/7, even if you happen to be up when you should be sleeping. If you happen to be up at 3 a.m. in the morning, you turn on the computer, you want to get to the internet for whatever reason. I don't know what you're doing at 3 a.m. in the morning, but okay. Say what? Oh, Facebook.
I don't know what you're doing. I'm writing up a document for Dr. Bocconi.
Give this man a bag. He's up that late at night doing work with Dr. Bocconi.
So, now,
that was a good one. Next slide, please.
Okay, before he goes on to the next slide, I have a question. How many of you in here know what these things mean, like IED?
Improvised explosive device.
WMD. So these words are proliferant through our society these days, right? Because it's a big concern that the government and everybody else unleashes on the population. What about stuff like this, supporting natural disasters? Can anybody think of anything that satellite technology or reconnaissance technology has contributed to in the last couple months?
The Japanese earthquake.
That was a little bit longer ago. Hiroshima?
No, it was Fukushima.
Fukushima, yes. The study of the radiation from those plants, people can't get close to it. yet. And we're getting to the point where you can get in there a little bit more, but for quite a while after that huge earthquake that they had, there was what? Tsunami warnings. People worried about that. And there's all kinds of technology out there, reconnaissance technology, that is used for tsunami warnings in conjunction with other types of reconnaissance. But also the overhead, right? Stuff that for tsunami warnings is not always overhead. It's in the ocean floor, floating in the ocean on buoys, and in other places that they have sensors all over the place that look at what is the state of that particular environment around it. And they all talk to each other to form these huge arrays, and then they talk to a central processor to give information back to whoever the receiver is for prediction of a tsunami. That's how they knew in a really short time, comparatively speaking, to tell people to start running when the earthquake came. But the other thing is overhead has been used, and the NGA and the NRO and some of the other agencies have donated time from the overhead collection devices to take pictures from space and from other overhead collections of the radiation. And they do it in all kinds of, if you look at these images, when you walk out, you're welcome to take one. These are all for you guys to take, but there's several of them, and these are from 1960, 1967 time frame. Now we do processing across the frequency spectrum. So if you're not a double E, that might not mean that much to you, but think about radio. Right, you have your visual spectrum where you see all these different colors, and then you have the radio frequency where you change your radio channel and you get all the different numbers. Right, so for the different frequency components in the spectrum, you get different pieces of information that you can visualize. And they call it false color in some cases, but they can see the radiation emanating from the different towers. And that's how the general public found out that there were actually explosions in three of the, what do they call those big things? They've got four of the big stacks, and three of the stacks had explosions. And those were discovered by overhead technology from NGA, NRO, CIA, NSA, that they donated the time for the birds to take those pictures.
So to give you a flavor for the advancement in technology, so the pictures that Penny was referring to here were done back in the 1960s. Here's some examples of some of the early satellites that the NRO put up for reconnaissance purposes. Just take a look at the pictures, you'd say, this is old. For one, it's in black and white. Yeah, this is indeed old. But they have advanced since then, and the types of images that they form are diverse. Let me put it that way. Who can tell me all the forms of imagery that you can think of?
You have, I'll give you, help you out, electro-optical. Those are your photographs. What else do you have? How else can you form images?
Hyperspectral.
Get that man a bag.
No, you're right. Infrared. Get this man a bag. And what else? What else you have?
Who, what? Someone said thermal? Isn't that infrared?
Who's got these?
Help me.
MRI.
MRI. Good. Get that man a bag. What else?
Cardioid.
No. Forms of images. X-ray. Get that man a bag. That man right there.
Okay, so what's no one happened to mention
ultrasonic.
That's a good one. No one happened to mention.
Who said ultrasonic?
The very end.
No one happened to mention radar imagery. Who did that? You said radar? Did you say radar? Got a bag. Okay.
I didn't want you.
Radar imagery is very cool, very important. One of the great attributes of radar imagery is that it can see in the clouds. So where electric optical gets blocked by clouds, radar imagery can see through the clouds. That's very important for the overhead aspect. So that was probably the first set of imagery that was put up and delivered by NRO systems. Of course, they've moved on from that since then, and they do many other diverse types of imagery. We moved on already. Okay, all of these guys are probably radar images taken by that satellite, the Corona satellite, from years gone by, perhaps when you guys weren't even born yet. But these images played an important role back then in terms of the intelligence community. I don't think that these satellite images show anything particular
They point out a missile site up there. I'm not quite sure what country, but what the heck. It was a missile site identified somehow through a radar image, which was very important at the time. Next slide, please, Penny. So, within that, obviously, given the nature of the NRO's business in general, they do perform some things that we call white space, that is to say, things that you might be able to hear about in the public domain. Meteorological data would be a good example of that. Communications may also be a good example. But then again, their core mission rests on this side. And these are things that outside of the intelligence community, you may not know about or ever hear about for quite some time. So I'm trying to get you to understand the sense of the importance. Why would the U.S. government support and stand up an organization called the NRO? I'll tell you why. It is germane to the sovereignty of our nation, which is very important. And the systems that are put up are ultimately very critical. Hence, they have to be very reliable. Very reliable. That other chart I showed you, where it said loss of life, well, what we're talking about when we say loss of life, we're talking about soldiers, guys who fight for your freedom. And we're trying to keep those guys safe so that our freedom stays intact. So these systems, when they're designed under a very rigorous design process that is intended to root out the problem long before you launch it. Dr. Piconi mentioned early on, one thing you do not have at your disposal when you launch a satellite, you can't get back at it. It'd be nice, maybe you guys can think about this, you know, somebody's doctoral dissertation, how I can tether a satellite, pull it back down, fix it, and put it back up. Well, until you do that, okay, that satellite and the systems on it have to be ultra reliable. Now, I've mentioned this word reliable several times. Anyone give me a definition? Do you have something from your class? What's your definition of reliable? What does that mean?
Doesn't bring any
advisors there. Okay, doesn't. Help this man out. What does reliable mean?
Repeatable results.
That's very good. Say, I want to hear you.
Performs the same way over a long period of time.
Get that man a bag. Performs the same way as designed over time.
So I designed that robot arm to move like this. It better do it until it dies. I don't want to move it like this. Okay? That would be unreliable because it did something I did not expect, nor did I design it for.
So that's the essence of reliability. So one of the things that you're going to have to face once you leave school here and get out into the professional world and start designing systems and products that are very critical to either someone's lives or someone's entertainment value. You don't want someone freaking out, okay? Keep you from freaking out at the very least. You can design systems that are highly reliable. And in so doing, that is indeed a very rigid design process that you should follow. Let's hit the next slide, please.
Let me ask a question first.
Okay.
How many of you have any idea what space is like? Outer space. Well, a satellite starts out on the ground, goes through a very long and complex, it can take as much as 10 years to launch a satellite. Okay, so you've got the launch vehicle, and then you've got the satellite. Both of those are separate, but highly integrated development processes that go through a life cycle that is very long, and very complex because of the reliability aspect. Because you can't save it, right? So you get one chance to make this puppy work, and only one. And if you fail, the whole world is looking at you because you just spent billions of dollars and potentially a decade trying to do something that fell on its face. Okay? But if you're successful and the thing gets out there in space and actually gets into operation, what is that environment like? Anybody have any thoughts on that?
Cold.
What degree of cold? Anybody have an idea?
Minus 150F.
And more.
Very hot.
And very hot, yeah.
Temperatures can vary like up to 100 degrees Celsius.
Way more than that. Hundreds. Radiation. Everything that goes into space has to be radiation hardened, right? It has to have EMI. How do you phrase that? guaranteed EMI protection. Anybody know what that means, EMI?
From magnetic impulse.
Interference. And half of the cycle, if you have a geosynchronous satellite, that's just going to sit looking at the same place, right, as it travels through space on planet. Half of its cycle is in the sun, which is can get extremely hot. The other half of its cycle is behind the planet, where it's not in the sun's view, and it gets extremely cold. So it goes through these huge variations, hundreds of degrees of Kelvin. I personally have been an engineer for a long time, and I still can't wrap my head around Kelvin. It's so big, right? And to think about a temperature variation that large is mind-boggling. Okay, so you have all these material processes that engineers have to go through and study and learn and develop so that when they put something like these satellites out in space, and they have to be out there for 10, 15, 20 years, undergoing these extremes every single cycle, they can't fail because they've gone from super hot to super cold, super hot to super cold for hundreds of cycles and thousands of cycles over the course of their lifespan. The plastics, the metals, the wiring, everything has to be radiation hardened and heat temperature sensitive, and every other extreme environmental stress that you could put something under these satellites get put under on a regular basis. So as an engineer, your job is to A, make sure you have redundancy, and B, that whatever you're designing is going to work for a long time and work right the first time. So the design engineering process that you're learning right now is critical to that. I listened to Joe tell me this morning what torture he's been putting you guys through, and from the experience, from coming from an experience of a background of dealing with people who have done a lot of design engineering for satellites and for airplanes, for ground collections and everything else, the design process, in my view, is so much more critical than the actual components that you have to put together. And that's critical, because you have to pay attention to making sure that when it goes together, it's going to survive and everything else. But if you don't have a good design, you are dead in the water when you have trouble.
Penny, you might also mention weight.
Weight.
On top of all that, it's got to be light, because every ounce is less
than... Yes. We refer to that as SWAP. Size, weight, and power. Those are always components that are... they're engineers that design satellites and launch vehicles deal cards with SWAP, right? They're constantly going through these reviews, and they're constantly debating and arguing and fighting over who's going to get more. So if you're a power engineer, you want more power, right? But you have to deal with the weight constraints and the size constraints and everything else. So you're going through this design process, and they go through many, many reviews, and each time they have to check their size, weight, power, and all the other requirements are being met. So, for instance, the most recent NASA design that's tabled right now, that was big news back a year ago, whenever it was, when it was tabled, when they were designing the replacement for the shuttle. They went through, at, I kid you not, probably 15 designs reviews where they scrapped the whole design and started over. Because between the size, weight, and power guys, they had so many fights and couldn't agree, and then they would go off and design something, and then they would come back to a design review and they would be overweight. And they couldn't agree. Well, I have to have this to make that happen. Right? And the other guys would say, well, I have to have this to make that happen. So that because they wouldn't adhere to the restraints and requirements that they were given during the design process, they ended up having to scrap it. I'm not kidding you, at least 6 times. And that's part of why they got canceled. Because by the time they had gone through this fight 6 or 7 times, they had spent, I don't know how many, billions of dollars. Because they couldn't figure out how to say, I've got this restraint on this weight, or this component in the system, and if I go to the table at the next review and I'm over, We're not gonna go forward.
Okay. So, some of the signals that they have to deal with, as I mentioned, there's a lot of different technologies that the NRO utilizes. Some of them we mentioned. Someone told. I gave you EO, electro-optical. Someone mentioned infrared for me, and I mentioned, or someone mentioned radar as well. Synthetic aperture radar is a technology that utilizes a method of making a small aperture device look like a large aperture device so that you can take a bigger picture, if you will. all of these different types of technologies are deployed in theater, and they are used as a national asset to help us do communications. They can be used for weather, some of the more lighthearted things, or I shouldn't say lighthearted things, things that are not related to intelligence necessarily. However, precision guidance and location, you can see how those things will play a big role in the Defense Department, if you will. Next slide, please. Yes, go ahead. Excuse me?
Can you talk a little louder?
I'm sorry, I will try to talk a little louder. Arms control, indications of warning. These are some of the things that are more prevalent in the Department of Defense. We want to know what's going to happen before it happens. That's called early warning. Could you imagine if we had a clue in before 9/11, before it happened? We probably could have saved some lives, but we didn't. Well, that's a different story. I won't get into that. But what I will say is that apparently we didn't have what we refer to as actionable intelligence, something that you do something with. And if we had that and take action on it, we could prevent loss of life. So that's the criticality involved in some of these systems that are deployed and how they play a role in both our national defense as well as the sovereignty of our nation. Next slide, please. And this might be coming towards the end here. Here's some of the more evolving missions that the NRO is playing a role in. Not only things done for the DOD, but also disaster relief. Some of that, Penny mentioned an example, utilizing the overhead assets to take imagery of the disaster in Japan, try to get an idea of what's going on, how it's spreading, so they can utilize that information to take action on it. Next slide, please. And chemical and biological weapons. Kind of knowing what those are is kind of important. Those there's a fear, at least, of the use of those types of devices being very ubiquitous around the world, used by our adversaries. So it would be nice if we can kind of figure out ahead of time if they indeed have that technology in their back pockets, as well as utilizing mobile targets, trying to find out if people are moving things around. Again, overhead assets are very important for that as well, giving you imagery and finding out what's going on. Next slide. And obviously, when you talk about the deployment of a satellite system, the biggest risk you have is that once you put this thing on a launch vehicle and it fires up, it doesn't go up. Or even more disastrous, it blows up. What you'd like to have happen is that everything that you designed to occur from the moment you set T0, it takes off, goes into orbit, deploys a satellite, satellite opens up and begins to do its mission as designed, reliably. What you get for it, some of the realities behind it, next, okay. You have competing demands, you have fiscal budget issues to deal with. Penny mentioned several times that you typically will spend lots of money in deploying these systems. So getting it right the first time is of the utmost importance. You have advocacy. What I mean by that is that there's always a fight between the different aspects of the branches of the military as well as the different departments of the intelligence community as they try to task these overhead assets that are deployed by the NRO. They might try to do so at the same time, and you got to kind of work things out with that as well. And then you have new challenges that are always coming up. So it is an evolving mission for the NRO, and the deployment of their systems are never stale. They are continually launching new things year after year. And now we're competing with commercial as well. And next slide here. So, in summary, we like to empower our decision makers, always in theater, first in. These are some of the things that the NRO desires to do. And they want to be available continuously worldwide and near real time and support the full spectrum of operations. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But right now what I want to get into is some of the thing that's more down to earth and closer to what you're having to deal with. So I think that is the last slide. Okay. So I mentioned earlier the very first thing you should do in the design process, the young lady told me, is get a problem statement. Now that problem statement, you as an engineer are probably going to try to extract from that requirement. And by the way, just about every system that you're going to design contains both things that are EE disciplined
oriented, as well as mechanical engineering, discipline oriented, and it may involve civil engineers as well. I'm not quite sure.
Nice.
But
nice. And industrial?
I'm sorry.
The materials?
How many civil engineers do we have here? I am sorry. I'm sorry. You guys build infrastructure and bridges for. We don't have those. We don't do anything. So I can't get my parts because I don't have a road for my truck to drive across. That's important.
Not laughing at that.
Okay. But nonetheless,
huh?
We're all civil engineers.
We're all civil engineers?
No,
we should get
back. We should get back. We could probably do that. So, in most systems you design, it is not a monolithic. What I mean by that, there's probably more than one discipline involved in the actual structure, the final product.
I have enough of these.
So,
the
system probably contains a multitude of what I call subsystems. And those subsystems have to be put together. And you might have parts of the system that are completely mechanical. So there's an arm on a robot, and the motor to drive it probably got designed by your mechanic guy. You that part of it. You guys are doing the electrical part of it, you're doing the control algorithm that's going to control that arm and dictate how it moves and moves around, and hopefully in a stable manner. If that robot is being used to build a bridge, okay, you got to be involved in telling it how to build a bridge. Nonetheless, it can be a very complex system where many components have to play together. And in so doing, there comes a point in time that these systems are designed by themselves, they have to come together. So let's talk about the engineering design process. You have these requirements, you can track it out of the process. And then you want to go through and do what next? What could you do next after you have these technical requirements, the essence of the project you want to take on? What would you do next? Excuse me?
No, that's not. That's too general. What would you do next?
Basic system diagram.
A basic system diagram. That's probably a good one to go after. Let me walk you through some of the things at a very high level that the NRO does in terms of deploying its systems. It, too, goes through a problem statement.
Probably the first slide that was up there, some of the problems that they have to encounter. And out of that, they extract ultimately some requirements. But they go through and do a requirements review, if you will. And what they do in the requirements review is to get everyone involved in the design at the same table and try to understand those requirements and see if they make sense. Then they would probably do a high-level design. Upon doing a high-level design, you might want to involve others, because how many of you guys are like Amadeus and get it right the first time? No one? Okay. You raise your hand? You like Amadeus? Okay. Never mind. The problem is that the reason why most of us work well in a team is because some of us have one view of looking at a problem, and it might be very good, but you might miss something. And your partner might have a different way of looking at it. So going through what we call a preliminary design review, it can be rough because it's, in essence, what you're doing is you put your design up, you explain to somebody, and they get to tell you what they don't like about it. That can hurt your feelings at times, but over time you develop this thick skin. You don't worry about it.
Think of Dr. Pagoni as your independent review team.
So he may tell you that, well, that circuit you just put up there will never work. Or it might work marginally. Or you forgot this requirement in the design of your circuit. Or he may tell you that you've completely left out this aspect of this requirement in the mechanical portion of your system. These preliminary design reviews are intended to flush out early issues, including the aspect of trying to design for reliability. So we've just presented some very important systems that the NRO deploys, and obviously they have to be reliable. Penny gave some hints at how you design for reliability. For example, you have to do something to have redundancy in the system just in case something fails, something else is there to take over, and the system can continue to work as designed. But you don't have time to pull that satellite back down to Earth, fix it, and put it back up. You don't have that luxury. So redundancy is something you might have to consider. Fault tolerance is something you want to have an analysis done about regarding your design. And what I mean by fault tolerance is, what if a fault occurs? What could be a fault? Give me an example of a fault that could occur in, let's say, an electrical system. What would be a fault?
A short circuit.
In the case of a short circuit, because, okay, you design your little circuit there, and you said, well, no one's going to be so stupid to put a wire across these two things, mistakenly. But guess what? The very thing you didn't think could happen will happen.
So here's a little case study. We've worked with a developer who had some really good engineers on the task. And here's the importance of system design review. So we have what we call gates. So you have your requirements review process, your design review from the global. So you're looking at your ConOps, your business case. What is this? What is the question that's being answered here? What is the service that's being supplied or the technology that's being asked for? So you start with that, you go down to the requirements review, and then you go to program design review and system design review and critical design review. So you have all these gates. And at any stage, the people who are actually the engineers doing that work can get sent backwards. And if they're bad enough, they can get just fired. Well, Tim and I have dealt with a particular contractor off and on for a while, who at times both of us would have liked to fire them, but you also have to deal with the politics and paperwork in any engineering position, and you have to learn to deal with people that you may not particularly appreciate dealing with and figure out how to get to yes, so to speak. So these guys did not do a requirements review, and we, the government, were in such a hurry to do this replacement capability that we let it go by. So with experience with satellite technology, we should have known better. And since we're supposed to be the subject matter experts, you know, spank us because we didn't hold our hand up and dig our heels in and say, no, don't do this. We kind of bought into the whole, this is going to go fast. We don't have time. We can review the stuff we need to review, which was not the case. And there are many, many requirements that got through the gate that were deficient. As a result, the design was deficient. So from that point on, the rest of the process of that particular project was incredibly painful. Right? And we paid a lot of the price, the developer paid a lot of the price, the government paid a lot of the price, because, you know, as the subject matter experts, we were in charge of interfacing with the developers and making sure they were doing their job right. When we detected there were problems in their development, it was our responsibility to inform the government and make the developer go backwards, and that includes arguing with the developer and making your case and proving to them that their design is bad. Not just, they can see it at some point, right? Sometimes it gets to the point where it's just failing. It's not doing what it's supposed to do. But a lot of times, you know, we can see from experience, you guys are headed down the wrong path. This thing is gonna go in this direction, and it's not gonna work right. And it may not be doing that right now, but I can tell you right now from experience that in 6 months or 8 months, it will fail. And almost with 100%, probably in the 90s, either he or I predicted with that particular developer one thing or another that ended up happening. And also almost with 100%, I hate to say success because it's really not success, the system requirements or the root problem. And that's way at the beginning. That's where Dr. Kuhn is telling you guys, your statement of work, your problem statement, your business plan, that's where that starts. Okay, I have this problem. And like Tim said, it's not a technical problem. It's a customer comes to you and says, I want you to put this thing in my store that collects information about my customers and tells me what sex are they, what height are they, how much money do they spend in here? How often are they in there? Stuff like that. You have to take it from there as the person in charge of the engineering project and say, well, what do I have to do to collect that information with this system? What do I need for? I have to figure out what components I need, if I need computers, if I need pieces, parts, how are they going to talk? Then I need to ultimately get to a plan where I have system design plans, schematics, drawings, and guess what? A bill of materials. Because I need to buy stuff, right? And I have to go to my customer and say, I've got this plan. Here's what I think I'm going to do. Give me some money. And you can't just say, well, let's see, I need a a receiver, and I need a transmitter, and I need a few capacitors, and I need a few resistors. No, you have to have line item by line item description for each piece and part, and a case to defend needing that, because in some cases, the government's going to say, or your customer's going to say, you can do it without that. I'm not paying for it. So you have to rethink, or you have to be able to stand up and say, here's why I have to have that particular piece, and lay out every single piece of evidence that states very clearly, you will not get what you want if you do not buy this expensive toy for me. So your requirements flow down come from that problem statement, so to speak. We refer to it as a con ops. But if you don't get that right, and then you don't get your subsequent immediate baby steps right at the beginning, we particularly have paid the price on that particular project over and over and over again with all the frustration and the money and the politics of that particular project, because of at each point where we realized there were requirements that were not fully fleshed out, the design was too far along. We couldn't go backwards. So if you have some hardware design, you have a board that you've spent money on, putting components on that board, making connections on that board, and you've gotten to that point where that board is in your hand, ready to plug in, and you realize it's not doing something I needed it for it to do, or it doesn't have an input-output resistance that I needed to have. How many of you know what the resistance of your TVs are, or any other cable in your house? TV cable, computer cable, anybody? That is a critical piece of information if you're going to design something that talks to another machine, right? So if you overlook it, and somebody builds something, and they end up dividing that with a resistance value that's different from what you need it to be, that's the kind of problem I'm talking about. You are way past recovery. It's going to cost a lot of money to go back and say, oops, darn it. I need to change the resistance of that connection. So then you have to figure out, either A, you're going to scrap the project, or B, some techniques for how do I get what I need? How can I match this? So, go ahead.
So, I mentioned earlier that often the products you design, the projects you work on, are fairly complex in the sense that they contain many subcomponents. And by the way, all the things we've been talking about here has been more about documentation and the importance of it, and less about the actual technical design. Let me give you one final example. As you move down the road with the design and things that you're intended to try and catch problems early, giving you a chance to correct them before you get to the point where you spend lots of money where you don't get it back. One of the other things you want to have, as far as understanding is concerned, is that between the various subsystems of your system, of your entire product, your project, your system, if they have to interface one another, that interface has to be well understood. What we do in many of our projects is we refine and document what we call an interface control document. An interface control document is given to the team who's designing subcomponent A and the team who's designing subcomponent B, so they understand how the interfaces will work. So at some point out there beyond the critical design review, when you start to actually, you've done your component level testing, if you will, then you're going to try and integrate the system together. That integration and testing effort begins. It's going to be very critical that those interface control documents were adhered to. To the extent that they are not, or if they're non-existent, you're almost guaranteed to have problems. And that's not fun once you're at a stage where you've built hardware and the professor's on your back about you having the next day to get this thing ready for show and tell, and you can't get things to work. So you don't want to have yourself in that kind of situation. And in order to avoid that, document the design up front. Document the interfaces up front. Test the components as you should, and then when you use integration and testing, that should be a fairly smooth process. To the extent that it's not, you can probably go back to where you did not design or be very vague on some aspect of the interfaces, and that leads to trouble. So, having said that, I don't think we have any more slides or anything, but in general, what I wanted to impress upon you is that there is indeed a way that you can design products very reliably and that they will work over time as designed if you indeed follow a process, a design process. And unfortunately, for engineers, we don't like writing things down, but we have to. To the extent that you document, it helps your team members to do a better design, especially if that team is not specifically doing your subject at all. So when you get down to the point where you're going to integrate, test this thing, that part of that design process will go hopefully a lot smoother, especially in the case of a satellite. You will have hopefully the thing on the right here as opposed to the thing on the left, which is not very good. Are there any questions?
Can you say just a couple quick questions? When that thing on the left happens, tell them what your life is like.
Oh, well.
Seriously.
Well, freaking out doesn't quite capture it, okay?
Because it's happened in recent years.
Because it has happened in recent years. So
let me give you an example that he probably hasn't had, because he hasn't been on one of the IR teams, the independent review teams, mm-hmm. yet. I keep trying to get him sucked in, and he keeps getting away. Sneaking out the door. The independent review teams oversee all of the NRO, the NGA, CIA, all of these stuff. So they're the only group in the government that can see across these agencies and see what they're doing. So we go and form small teams and review the technology development as it's in process. It's kind of seems sort of boring what we've been talking about here, but if you do good engineering, you're actually getting to do the fun stuff while you do the irritating documentation. It should be happening simultaneously. So you actually get to do the fun, hands-on, develop the stuff, play with it, test it, experiment with it. But part of that is to take that step aside and do that documentation, and some of it should be first. Like if you're going to design a circuit or design a board or design a mechanical system, you should be doing that, writing down and doing your analysis and doing your modeling while you're doing the other stuff. But if you're on an independent review team and something like this has very recently happened, okay, with one of the very well-known people who... Does anybody in here know who any of the satellite or launch vehicle companies are? Yes. Bad for you. Orbital is what he said. Orbital Sciences is a huge developer of launch vehicles and satellites, and they had a failure recently. And we were part of the independent review team because they were developing that for NASA. So NASA works with us in conjunction with us, and we do a lot of their independent reviews. So when that happened, anybody on the development team, anybody on the launch team, anybody on the review team, management, everybody that has been within a million miles of that vehicle, their pager starts going off. And it doesn't matter what time it is, you better get back to work. And you can plan on being there for a long time. So there's a whole lot of explanation that has to go on and justification, which frequently doesn't work. And if you're one of the people who actually had something to do with the failure, if they actually can figure that out, you might not have a job. So fortunately on the IRT, I don't have that problem, but there were people at Orbital that definitely got let go on the last go-around with that failure. And we, on the IRT team for that particular project, fortunately I was on that one, I've been on others, spent days at work after the fact. And we actually were working with that company, not with that group, at that time, so the whole company came to a halt. The day it happened, we were talking to some of the people at the company, and they basically were in mourning.
Not fun at all. I mean, you can imagine that if you spend a lot of money, you're giving some engineering team lots of money to do a project for you, and at the very end, it ends in a disastrous result. On a scale of something like this, you would tend to get what I call kind of passionate about it. And if you want to see grown men and women act like children, you know, waste $10 billion and see what happens. It really is not very fun. Kind of, it will freak you out. It really will.
All right. Well, I want to thank our speakers today. Tim. Thank you. I'll be here a little bit after the talk, but, you know, this wasn't staged. You're thinking, oh, he just dragged two people in off the street and would say everything that he teaches in this class, but they're very talented, but there's thousands or tens of thousands of people like them in the government or in other organizations that do this kind of work on a daily basis. Thank you. Next week, the 26th, means what for the Senior Design 2 teams?
We're done.
Over.